All right. Well, global warming is a sword with two edges. By the way, what swords don't have two edges? Anyway. And we have a gentleman here who can tell you all about it. He is Professor Stanley A. Temple, who is right now getting national attention for early springs occurring in the Midwest and the East. And this is him. I can call him Stan, because he's here at the University of Wisconsin, and I'm a Badger, too. So you made national news. Is your phone ringing off the hook?
Yeah, it actually has been.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's my name. I think it's the fact that the article used data from Aldo Leopold and Henry David Thoreau.
Yeah.
Names that are a little more famous than mine.
Did you know them personally?
No.
Aldo, maybe.
No, afraid not.
Before our time, huh?
I ended up with his position at the University of
Wisconsin. You are the new Aldo Leopold.
Well,
yeah.
I wish.
And Aldo Leopold, is like in Wisconsin at least, it's probably everywhere now, but sort of like St. Aldo in terms of environmentalism and really looking at ecology and all those things.
His book, A Sand County Almanac, is often called the Bible of the modern environmental movement, so maybe that makes him a saint.
Yeah. Was he what inspired you to go into this field?
Well, I certainly was one of the individuals who did. I read his book when I was a teenager and was very inspired by it.
Yeah. And one of the things that he did was he kept extensive journals and notes about when things were blossoming in early or late or whatever. And that's been invaluable in sort of tracking what has happened in terms of temperatures.
It really is. You know, the 19th century naturalists kept journals in which they noted most of the things that they observed when they were out in nature. Unfortunately, that's sort of a dying art today. Somehow Facebook and Twitter don't quite replace a journal.
Do you keep one yourself?
A journal, I do. Yes, I do. Yeah. But Aldo Leopold's journals and Henry David Thoreau's journals were really very detailed in that they monitored hundreds of natural events. And fortunately, they were famous writers, so their journals got preserved so that we can go back and look at them and try to make some sense out of how things have changed.
And thanks to Thoreau, we know we can eat a woodchuck if
that's
desperate.
True. Best to parboil them, as I recall.
Yeah. Walden Pond there.
Yeah.
But I think for a while he's actually on Emerson's front lawn, just living there in a little hut.
Yeah, Walden Pond's a very different place today, of course.
Is it? Have you been there?
Yes, I have, yeah. 1850s, it was out on the fringes of Boston, and now it's pretty much surrounded by suburbia and is pretty much a suburban park.
Mm-hmm. And Aldo Leopold's bailiwick?
Aldo Leopold's shack is still out in the country in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It is. It's a National Historic Landmark, the only chicken coop so designated.
But was there a Mrs. Aldo Leopold? Is that why he was in a chicken coop?
There certainly was. Yeah. Estella Leopold, his wife.
Yeah. Was she in favor of his research or just to get him out of the house?
She was very supportive. I think the whole family got into weekends up at the shack.
Yeah.
A place to get away from Madison for the weekend.
And pretty much by looking at what happened then, what did he look at? What sort of plants did he look at?
He looked at hundreds of plants, hundreds of different animals, and most people who keep these journals, they are very anxious to record the first event of the year, when the first plant blooms, when the first robin migrates back to Wisconsin, and so forth. So his notebooks were full of all kinds of details, but the ones we were particularly interested in for this study was when did different plants first bloom during the year.
Give me a for instance. What plants are we talking about here?
Well, he took the whole gamut from trees like cherries down to bushes like service berries, down to plants like passflowers or a bloodroot or trillium. Mm-hmm. He pretty much covered the bases. There weren't many plants or animals.
Did you do crocuses?
Well, there weren't many crocuses around the shack.
No.
It's pretty much a rural place. But
that's more of a city thing to put in crocuses, I suppose.
Yeah. There was a lilac tree that Mrs. Leopold planted in front of the shack to dress it up, and there are lots of notes about when the lilac tree bloomed. It's still there.
Same
lilac tree, yeah.
She isn't, but the tree is.
That's true.
And by looking at those, let's say, trilliums, let's say, was that one of his favorites? the trillium?
Yeah, people like trillium. They like early spring wildflowers. It's sort of...
And that would be one of the first ones to bloom in spring.
It would be early, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so in what year are we talking about here? What days?
Well, Aldo Leopold kept his journals at the shack from, mm-hmm. from 1945 and until he died mm-hmm. In 1947. Mm-hmm. But Aldo Leopold's notes go all the way back to his childhood.
Oh.
His journals go all the way back to when he was 8 years old.
Do we know his earliest trillium?
We certainly could go back and look, and I can almost picture in my mind one of his earliest journal entries, which was back in the late 19th century when trillium was certainly on the list.
Yeah. Give us some dates here now. I know I saw something in the article here, but I'll let you say it. Something that bloomed in his day, and when that was, and what it was.
Well, what we discovered was that we could make comparisons to how things happened in the 1930s and 40s mm-hmm. to when they're happening today.
Right.
And for the dozens of plants that we monitored, they were all blooming much earlier, in some cases as much as a month earlier than they did in Aldo Leopold's time.
Mm-hmm.
The second question was, of course, well, why is this happening? So we were able to go back and look at the dates on which these plants flowered and compare that to the temperature in the years. And we found a very tight correlation between the average spring temperature during March, April, and May mm-hmm. and the dates on which these plants bloomed.
Do you happen to have that data with you? I'd like to look it over.
And 2012, of course, was off the chart. It was the warmest year on record, and most especially, it was the warmest spring on record.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really just was off the charts. And it struck us that this was an opportunity, actually, to do something that scientists always want to do, and that is extrapolate their data
mm-hmm.
to make predictions that are really outside the bounds of what they've already observed. And 2012 was clearly out of the bounds of anything that had been observed in the past. So we ask the simple question, could you have used the historical relationship between temperature and flowering date?
Mm-hmm.
Could we have predicted the record early flowering of 2012? And it turns out we can't.
Yeah. Shouldn't you have been asking, why didn't we predict it?
Well, if you're into the negative approach, yeah.
Shouldn't we be looking at 2000, let's say, 15 or something like that?
So in 2012 was so warm in the spring, it was actually the average temperature last year was close to what climate scientists predict is going to be the average in the second half of this century.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave us a little
peek at the future. Is there a number there? Because we're in Wisconsin here, and any help would be...
Sure. Last spring, the average temperature in March, April, and May mm-hmm. was 54 degrees Fahrenheit, which is downright balmy.
That is.
Considering that we're you and I are old enough that we probably remember the good old days when it snowed in May and
no, I don't remember that. opening day, Milwaukee Braves. Snowed on.
That's right.
Yeah, and that was April, first week of April.
Though, yeah,
not May.
So it really has changed dramatically, and as I said, it gives us a peek into the future. And what we saw, you know, isn't particularly welcome news because there are a lot of problems that are created by a particularly warm early spring.
Mm-hmm. But it's pluses and minuses, though. I mean, come on, we're in Wisconsin. Come on. You know, we could stand a bit of warming, maybe not, you know, you don't want a lot. You don't want Michigan to
rise
over its banks or whatever it would do, you know.
Nice to hang up those winter clothes.
Yeah.
But, if you're in nature, if you're not a human being living mm-hmm. in an air-conditioned, warmed house, what's happening out there in the climate really has some pretty big impacts on your lives.
Significant.
Yep.
What impacts, for example?
Well, in Wisconsin last year, we had some fairly dramatic agricultural consequences of that very early spring. There was almost a complete failure of the Door County cherry crop because of the early spring. The cherry trees blossomed at an all-time record early date, only to subsequently be hit by a frost so that they lost their blossoms and
happened in my yard.
Cherries.
Yard, I have a nice little cherry tree. They're crummy little cherries, you know, all pit and very little cherry.
Yeah.
But bloomed really, and it was beautiful. I got all kinds of pictures of it. And then I went out and I noticed that nothing had actually grown on it.
Yeah.
You know, there were no
cherries. Same with my cherry tree. Yeah. And same with a lot of cherry trees. And there was a wonderful headline in
the tree the canary of this mine?
Well, it could be. Yeah. You could take it as something that would indicate, hey, something's really wrong here.
Yeah.
There was a wonderful headline of the Milwaukee papers last spring. It said, "No cherry pie for you, climate change deniers." But it wasn't just cherries in Wisconsin. If you go over to western Wisconsin in the Driftless area, they had a really hard time with their apple crop. Mm-hmm. And it was a slightly different problem. Mm-hmm. The apple trees broke dormancy and flowered before there were enough bees around to pollinate the flowers.
Yeah.
And as a result, the same problem, the flowers didn't get pollinated, and without pollination, you don't get apples.
Probably fewer bees, too, as a result.
Well, yeah. In fact, as many of you will know, people have to truck bees in.
Very small trucks.
The native bee. Well, they're actually very big trucks filled with
thousands
of hives.
Of course. Yeah.
And here in Wisconsin as well, I think we're, the third or fourth largest producer of maple syrup?
Mm-hmm.
Not last year.
No.
It was pretty much a wipeout because maple trees require a particular temperature regime of warming and freezing in order to produce a good crop of sap that we can turn into maple syrup, and that didn't happen last year. So
what temperature does a maple tree like? Or is that field?
That's certainly not my field to know, but I certainly enjoy the maple syrup that results when you get the right combination of temperatures.
Yeah, me too.
And it was pretty much a wipeout throughout the Northeast. I read a headline that they had busted some folks on the Vermont border.
The Canadian.
Smuggling in Canadian maple syrup so they could label it as Vermont maple syrup.
Yeah, like those Canadian. They'll smuggle anything. You know, cigarettes, maple syrup, you know, cheese.
Beer.
There's a big cheese ring up there in Canada.
Yeah.
So
it has consequences. It's not just, you know, worrying about wildflowers. It has consequences for us in our agricultural crops.
However, now, is this an anomaly or is this... What's the opposite of an anomaly? A trend or something?
Well, it is a trend, of course.
It is, yes.
It is a trend, and we can certainly see that in the climate data, which for Wisconsin goes back well over a century. And it's no question, it's getting warmer, just as the climate scientists have predicted. And, of course, we get, along with that warming climate, we get unusual weather events, extreme, not climate. Climate is sort of the average conditions, but you get the extremes. And we've certainly had some extremes in Wisconsin this year, last year, with drought as well as the heat.
Yeah. But can these be like normal cyclical variations that occur over, you know, longer periods of time than we're used to thinking of, perhaps? Or
there certainly are those big cycles.
Yeah.
And if you are into the deep history of cycles of climate on Earth, you would predict that we should be in a period of cooling.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, we're in a very rapid, unprecedented period of warming.
Yeah.
So we've actually reversed the long-term trend that has been going on for millennia.
That's interesting. There was a Wisconsin era at one time, wasn't there? Was that geologic,
sure.
Or was that also...
The Wisconsin glaciers.
Yeah.
The Wisconsin
glaciation. So that certainly would affect...
That was a big part of that.
That affects your day.
Bigger cycle of, right, yeah.
A glacier.
Aldo Leopold, you know, his records were quite precise. You know, he took lots of notes, but probably I think one of the most amazing things both about Henry David Thoreau and Aldo Leopold is that they weren't taking these notes as data. They were simply taking these notes because they enjoyed being out in nature and they wanted to record the things that they had observed. And Aldo Leopold had a great line in one of his essays. He, of course, had both Thoreau and Leopold were good with words.
Mm.
And in referring to his note-taking habit, Aldo Leopold said, "Keeping records enhances the pleasures of the search and the chance of finding order and meaning in these events."
Mm-hmm.
Aldo Leopold wrote his notes all about the pleasure of the search. Yeah, it took us 75 years to dig into those notes and find the order and meaning in them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And then, of course, the larger picture is what's causal and what makes this happen, what's causing this to happen. It's not really your field to
not,
do
not
that.
Especially my field. As yes. an ecologist, I'm more interested in the consequences.
In the consequences and stuff. Mm-hmm. But can you, from data, can you infer what cause may be?
We certainly believe the climate scientists, the data that they present, despite some of the popular misconceptions, there is almost universal agreement among scientists that climate change is human caused.
That's fossil fuels and...
Yeah, producing excess carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the environment. It's a big problem, and, you know, as someone once said, you know, 85% of the public believes in climate change, and the remaining 15% are in Congress. It's quite remarkable that something as important as climate change can be turned into a political football, but it certainly has been.
Yeah. Now, someone or young people who are kind of interested in this and maybe want to go into this field or they want to know more about, what are some good resources to learn more about it and the research that's going on and places to go? Where can people go to find out?
Well, there's an organization that does a good job of putting out information aimed at the general public, 365.org, by Bill McGibbon, who has sort of put aside his writing for a while to become something of an activist on informing the public about climate change.
Yeah. And since you did mention the political aspect of this, Congress and so forth, is there any cross or party agreement on these things, or is it all down to politics as to, you know, representing producers of emissions versus the general public? Or is there some general acknowledgement that this is occurring and something needs to be done, and is it transcending the political atmosphere at all, or is that...
It doesn't seem to be, yeah. And the sociologists are having a ball studying how people react to the news from scientists about climate change and other aspects of the world that are clearly supported by the evidence. There certainly are a group of people who tend to be sort of anti-science, who just don't want to believe things that don't line up with their personal worldview, despite what the evidence might suggest. Mm-hmm. Not all of them are in politics, but quite a few of them seem to be.
Yeah. And in terms of your projections now from your data and so forth, because you can make projections, what do we see, let's say, in the next 10 years, a continuation of this increase in temperatures?
I would say, at least in terms of all the plants and animals that we have been monitoring, they're going to continue to respond, as they always have, to climate change. The problem is that not all species respond the same way. Mm-hmm. Early spring wildflowers, the ones that we addressed in this current paper, tend to respond very strongly to temperature, but not all species do. And that ends up creating the same type of out-of-sync problem that the apple trees and the bees had in western Wisconsin, where two species that have some important interaction with one another, like a plant and its pollinators, get out of sync. They wake up at a different time in the spring, and as a result, an important ecological service doesn't get accomplished. And we're going to see more and more of that.
Yeah. And I would think the animal species as well, because I noticed that the geese don't leave anymore.
That's right.
That's got to be significant.
Well, it is. And, you know, we always think of robins and bluebirds as the harbingers of spring, or at least that's the pattern in the historical literature. And, of course, here in Madison, Wisconsin, we have robins and bluebirds with us year-round. They just don't leave. It's so warm in the winter now.
Yeah, and the geese. That's the big
problem. Well, the geese, yeah. We have geese that not only don't leave, but, you know, they tend to...
They run the joint.
They hang out in places where they compete with us.
They are mean. You ever walk up to a goose? I'm just walking I'm walking past a goose, and they take it personally.
That's right. The word goose has a biological origin.
That should be the last word on this. Thank you very much. Professor Stanley A. Temple, ladies and gentlemen, from the University of Wisconsin. Thank you very much for coming in.